So this is Friday, May the 12th, and it's 2017. Wow. Anyway, I had a conversation with a friend of mine today, and she was asking how we built our superfood business, and I thought I'd just walk through some of what you might I learned by running live events for years and years. First off, we ran live events out of our house because we just started that way, and most of the people that we were interacting with were acceptable to have in our house. And looking back, I realized there were certain things we did to ensure our space was edited properly. In other words, we never had any challenges with people coming into our house, even strangers, because they were typically pre-edited by the content I produced for our meetup group and meetup events. So, trying to discuss exactly how that occurred might be a little bit challenging. I'd just say, you know, make sure that you set your frequency or whatever you require for people in your house to be very clear, and then write all your content around that. And if you're really deeply involved or committed to certain ideals in your life, more than likely people are going to gravitate to those ideals who are in alignment, and people who are out of alignment will be repelled. So I guess the simple way of saying how to have events in your home is really deeply dive into whatever your ideals are and become extremely firm about your ideals and sharing your ideals. So that's if you're doing events in your home. Now, if you're just starting out and your home space is really small or inconducive to a bunch of people parking on the street, like if you have an apartment or something, you could use your apartment's, more than likely they have some sort of community center, most apartment complexes do. Or you can use the Tupperware model, which is what I'd strongly recommend, is you network with people, and you can find people to network with by way of meetup again. Just go and attend a bunch of events which are aligned with what you believe and your ideals, and you'll meet a bunch of new people and set up events in their home. So it's just like Tupperware. Their business model was they ran events in people's homes, and the people's homes where the event was running invited people they know, which are more than likely people you don't know yet. So those are the general ways of arranging event venues. Now, once you have the event, organizing the flow of time through the entire start to end timeline of the event is very important. And you might not learn this after years and years of running events. I guess we ran 2 to 3 live events in our home every month for almost 10 years, which is that was a lot of events. And by the way, if you're running food events, just be aware you're going to have a lot of cleanup involved too. And there's going to be some breakage, and you'll have to be very firm on your rules and guidelines that you provide to people in your opening circle, which is how we always arranged our events. Is after running events for about a year, I became extremely firm about the exact timeline. So when I said we're going to get started at 6:30, people knew that at 6:30 on the dot, we were going to have an opening circle. And here's what I mean by an opening circle, is everybody gets around in a circle. So hopefully you're going to have a room big enough to do that. And everybody has an opportunity to say their name and make a announcement if they like. Here's the challenge with announcements, though. This is not meant to be some sort of situation where somebody's going to ramble on for 10 or 15 minutes about their life story or their project's history. What I told people, and I actually said this in our events, was say your name And if you have an announcement, you can make one announcement, one sentence long. And most people ain't going to be interested in your project or your activity or whatever. And so this ain't meant to be something where you tell your whole story. You just make a single sentence announcement, and the people who are inspired to participate with you will come and find you and ask you more questions, and those that aren't inspired won't. So you don't waste everybody's time by rambling on. So opening circle, everybody goes around, says their name, says a one sentence announcement if they like. And then we normally had some sort of prayer or starting. Had a little special effects there from the poodle in the window. So opening circle, name, announcement, some sort of prayer or salutation or whatever, and then guidelines like, you know, if you're doing a food event, you know, go through, tell people exactly where the line is or how to go through the line, because otherwise everybody's going to come at food from different angles and you're going to end up with a log jam. And then where they should eat, and, you know, if they're eating on carpet, make sure that they're instructed to have no open containers of fluids unless it's just water. And if you make a mess, get with the host and you clean it up. Because if the host has to clean up, you know, if there's 100 people in the house and the host has to clean up 100 messes, that's all they're going to be doing all night. So you'll figure out, especially if you're doing this in the same venue like your own home, you'll figure out the guidelines and directions you require giving people. So we would typically open the circle at 6:30, and as soon as the circle was closed, we would go and get food. And then we'd normally have some sort of time, like say 8 o'clock. So from 6:30 to 8 was eating and, you know, fellowshipping with each other, having conversations, getting to know each other. And then at 8 o'clock, I would usually do some sort of topic talk. It might have been a guest speaker that came in. It was usually me. And if you do have a guest speaker, here's what I would suggest. Rather than charging, we tried lots of different formats, and we always found that this netted the guest speakers more income, is rather than charging a cover price, is just ask for a love offering. And just say, you know, there's a container up on the you know, mantle here, or over here by the, you know, someplace out of the way, and just, you know, contribute whatever you like. And we did that to cover our expenses also, because we normally provided things like napkins and eating utensils and plates. And I know most people, at least in the vegan community, are really hip on recycling. I got to tell you, if you have to wash eating utensils, plates, knives, cups and everything for 100 people, that's a big job. So we usually used recyclable materials that broke down, and we just tossed them in the trash. Oh, I know, I can hear the vegans in the crowd catcalling, but that's what we did. Otherwise, we'd have been cleaning up for hours every night after an event. Now, here's the way that we monetized and built our superfood business, which, by the way, I didn't really start out to do this, and it just happened organically, but, and I'll tell you how I did it so you can perhaps duplicate it much faster and more efficiently than we did, is we started out by having, Yumaya would normally fix 2 or 3 or 4 dishes for people to enjoy. And the first sort of round of monetization we went through was people would ask her, how the heck did you make something that tasted so good? Because most vegan food, I got to tell you, tastes like freaking cardboard to me. And I rarely eat at restaurants. In fact, let's see, I guess both times that we've gone to Hawaii recently here for month-long vacations, the first thing people ask us when we get back is, where'd you eat? And, well, in our kitchen, because sort of the food we fix is way better than any restaurant could ever fix, could ever possibly fix food. And I'm talking about, you know, supposedly five-star vegan chefs. And there's been a lot of chefs, vegan chefs, that are well-known that have come through our home. And they've said that Yemaya's food was by far the best they ever had. In fact, there's a well-known vegan chef, one of the first, Giuliano, that was here doing a workshop at our house back in, Lord, 2002 or 3 or 4. And he's going through his workshop, and he just got off a plane, and he asked Yemaya for something to eat because he was hungry. And she gave him a bunch of just simple crackers that she'd made and some other things that she'd made. And he's eating this and giving an introduction to his course, and he just stops and he looks at her and he says, "You're not ever planning on opening a restaurant, are you?" And she said, "Lord, no." And he said, "Good, because so far you're my only competition." And that was pretty typical. Yemaya's preparatory skills are stellar. So our first round of monetization was she taught courses of how to do vegan preparation. And boy, that was a pretty time and labor intensive situation also. And I really ought to republish all those videos on YouTube so people have access to those. I could probably dig those out of the archive. So that was the first round. And then the second round was people really like the chocolate drink that I made, which is actually, I guess I happen to have a container right here of Chocolate Bliss. And people kept asking me how I made it, and I kept giving them recipes, and then they'd come back the next live event, and they'd say, "Well, I tried to make your Chocolate Bliss, and it doesn't taste anything like yours." And it was because they were using different ingredients, and the ratios were a little bit off. So we started packaging Chocolate Bliss and a whole bunch of other products, superfood products. And that's kind of how things started. In fact, the first round of packaging we did, rule of thumb in any business is get her done. So if you have a business idea and you can't make a sale by the end of the day, my rule of thumb is it's a bad idea, get another one. So our first packaging was Chocolate Bliss powder in Ziploc bags. There were no labels. There were just Ziploc bags of, you know, stacks of Ziploc bags that people bought. And the next round was we had square paper labels that just had text on it. And then the final round was this packaging here that's Sunfire Superfoods, the big red and yellow label with the palm trees. So you really don't have to have anything fancy to do packaging for your products if you are manufacturing your own products. My suggestion would be, if you're going to do a superfood business and you'd like to make a, you know, truckload of money with the least amount of headaches in the fastest amount of time, open wholesale accounts with people that manufacture the products that you enjoy yourself, and then resell those products, because I guarantee you'll know more about the products you use than just randomly, you know, thinking that you can sell some product that you've never used. And that's why some of our dealers that sell our superfoods make some fairly substantial money, because we give some deep discounts in large quantity volume, and it's up to the dealer to manage the reselling of those products. In other words, we don't do drop shipping. We sell cases or pallets of product to other dealers, and then they take care of putting those products on Amazon or reselling them to their particular audience in their local cities. And a lot of people ship product now all over the world just like we do. So we ship to dealers all over the world. A lot of people ship retail all over the world. So the way that we generated the initial sales that bootstrapped our business was a simple model. Is I took what I was making, the chocolate drink I was making every day and living on, and I made up the final version, in other words, liquid chocolate drinks, and handed out samples to people, and then people bought product to make it at home. Now here's a little trick, and I guess I'll wrap up with this. There are a couple of tips that I'd give you about making finished products, especially if you're making Chocolate Bliss. Use the recipe I suggest, and your final product will turn out awesome, and you'll sell a lot of raw materials. If you mech around with the recipe, it won't taste right, and people won't buy the product to the raw materials to make their own product. The other thing is, if you hand out free samples to people every time that you have an event, you're going to be handing out a bunch of free samples to some people who are just taking advantage of your goodness. So I made a rule that instead of just giving out free samples to anybody, I only gave free samples out to people who it was their first time there. So in other words, if you already know how good Chocolate Bliss is, don't be asking me for free samples. Buy a product, make it yourself, and bring it in sealed containers. We always had a rule in our house that it was only sealed containers. In other words, get PET bottles of bottled water and put your Chocolate Bliss in it, and or whatever else you're drinking, and close the top. So that cut down on people coming in, you know, just taking advantage of my goodness and drinking a bunch of product. So the other little trick, and the last one I'll leave you with, is if people, it wasn't their first time and they wanted a glass of Chocolate Bliss, I just told them to serve themselves and then go throw $5 in the donation jar. I also tended to start off handing out Chocolate Bliss before everybody ate, because if they drank Chocolate Bliss, a lot of times that would dramatically reduce their hunger because it's so nutrient dense, and people would eat less food. So there'd be more food to go around for people to taste. The other trick that I learned was, if you find some really high quality essential orange oil that actually tastes like oranges. I mean, there's some orange oil that just tastes extremely caustic because it is, and there's some orange oil that tastes like oranges. You can do some experiments. Some orange oil is so strong that 3 drops will do it. Some orange oil is a little bit lighter in flavor and you'll require 10 or 12 drops. What I would typically do is I would make up a gallon of Chocolate Bliss and put any place from 3 to 10 or 12 drops of orange oil in it and shake it up right before people started arriving at 6:30, and what I found was the aroma of orange oil in the air from just mixing it in with Chocolate Bliss, and also from the off-gassing of the aroma of orange oil from everybody's glasses of Chocolate Bliss that they were drinking, tended to produce roughly 30% more sales every time. And I tried this going on, off different events. And every time I used orange oil, the sales would bump up right around 30% or more. So a little tip, try some orange oil when you're making your Chocolate Bliss. And if you look on YouTube, if you look for a video called Chocolate Bliss Version 2, and I guess I ought to do a Chocolate Bliss Version 3. Just make myself a note there of how I make it now, because I make it a little bit differently than I did back then. So that recipe will give you a good enough product that people will buy a lot of, though. So that's kind of a quick look at how we ran our events and managed rooms and product flow and things like that. One last tip, I guess I always say about coaching, because a lot of people may ask you for one-on-one coaching, and here's the way that I run my coaching. I do my coaching at a flat rate, usually $1,000 a month for unlimited coaching time. Here's the ground rules for that time, though. It ain't therapy. In other words, I ain't spending, you know, 8 hours a day for 2 or 3 days a week talking with people about their random problems. That ain't the way I do coaching. The way I arrange my coaching or design my coaching is, we talk until my client has a action item to do. So if you, for example, if you and I were doing coaching together, you'd pay $1,000 at the top of the month and you'd have unlimited time, and we'd have a short conversation. The first conversation we have might be a little bit longer. After that, the subsequent conversation is going to be really short, though. sometimes less than 5 minutes. And the only goal of a conversation is to get to one next actionable item you can take. Once you have that actionable item, there's no, I mean, it's just wasted space. There's no purpose for continuing a long conversation where you're telling your story or I'm telling my story and we're just, you know, ruminating about stuff which is unproductive. It's way better for, in a coaching situation, for you and me to talk about what's required for you to get to your next action step rather than telling a bunch of stories. So it's better to come to an action step early in a conversation and you go have an hour of time to take action rather than you and I talking on the Skype or the phone for an hour. So that's I'll mention that because you'll probably get a lot of people who will ask you to coach with them. And, you know, I would say, you know, do your coaching that way. And if you do, if you are going to have a physical meeting with somebody, I'd suggest you charge $100 for half an hour. And, you know, limit your, in other words, limit your time to short chunks of time so that people are clear that they have to get, you know, they've got to get their conversation done quickly and you're going to give your direction quickly and they're going to be gone and out of your office and taking action rather than sitting in your office talking. So anyway, that's a quick take on my thoughts about running rooms and events and dealing with huge customer bases.